Democrats to stretch out their apparent opposition to the Iraq policy all summer, negating their advantage on some other election issues. In the fall, Bush brought a war resolution to Congress, forcing the Democrats, including Bush's future opponent in the November general election, Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, to put themselves on record as supporting it. Bush then took his case to the UN in a powerful speech in which he offered not one shred of new evidence against Saddam Hussein. Quite the contrary, he outlined 11 years of Iraqi violations of the UN's own resolutions. It was a masterful performance to the extent that it forced the UN to either act against Iraq or admit impotence and become completely irrelevant. The UN gave the administration a new resolution, and even Syria voted yes. Then Bush faltered badly. The anti-war left utterly hated him with an irrational rage that ultimately proved insurmountable. He alienated his conservative base and the same group that had just given him the Senate majority by pushing through big government programs such as national education standards and a Medicaid reform that included a new prescription drug bill, the single biggest entitlement since the Great Society. Although he was successful in rolling back some traditionally liberal bastions, such as in the area of abortion, where his executive orders actually restricted abortions on federal property using federal funds, Bush began to lose ground. The Axis of Evil. Having targeted Iraq, Iran, and North Korea as an axis of evil in his 2002 State of the Union speech, Bush continued to receive information tying Saddam Hussein's Iraq to terror networks. Ansar al-Islam operated in the northern part of Iraq. Salman Pak, a training facility in Iraq, featured 737 jetliner fuselages that served little purpose except to give terrorists practice at taking over aircraft. Saddam harbored terrorist Abu Nidal. He had funded the families of Palestinian suicide bombers, and so on. Bush decided that it was too dangerous to allow al-Qaeda to obtain chemical or biological weapons that virtually all nations had conceded were in Iraq. It is worthwhile, in light of subsequent claims that there were no weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, in Iraq, to recount the large number of intelligence agencies worldwide that insisted Saddam had WMDs. Clinton and Gore both had warned of the dangers of WMDs, and in 1998, a group of Democratic senators, including John Kerry, Carl Levin, and Ted Kennedy, all urged Clinton to invade, if necessary, to remove the weapons. British, Russian, Chinese, Israeli, and most NATO intelligence services agreed Saddam had WMDs. And in 2002, when General Tommy Franks visited Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and Jordanian King Hussein, they both told him Saddam had WMDs. Hans Blix, the United Nations weapons inspector, reported in 2003 no convincing evidence that Iraq's stocks of anthrax were ever destroyed, while there was strong evidence that Saddam had produced more anthrax than he admitted, and at least some of this was retained. In September 2002, in his address to the United Nations, Bush detailed dozens of violations by Iraq. Bush and Powell succeeded in obtaining a unanimous resolution from the UN Security Council, Resolution 1441, that required new vigorous inspections of Iraq and a full disclosure by Saddam of all of his WMD programs. After UN inspectors reported violation after violation, Bush concluded an invasion would be inevitable. In his 2010 memoir, Decision Points, Bush chafed at the assertion the United States rushed to war. It had been more than a decade since the Gulf War resolutions had demanded that Saddam disarm, over 4 years since he had kicked out the weapons inspectors, 6 months since I had my ultimatum at the UN, 4 months since Resolution 1441 had given Saddam his final opportunity, and 3 months past the deadline to fully disclose his WMD. Diplomacy did not feel rushed. It felt like it was taking forever. Building a larger alliance than his father in 1991, on March 17, 2003, Bush gave Saddam and his sons 48 hours to leave Iraq or face war. Exactly 3 days later, the United States, having convinced the Iraqis that any new conflict would look much like the Gulf War with a long, protracted bombing campaign called Shock and Awe, instead launched a single intensive airstrike against a location where informants had said Saddam and his sons were. Saddam was not killed, but instantly the Iraqi army began to behave as though it had lost all command and control. Coalition forces tore through Iraqi resistance, even as pundits and military commentators, embedded generals, as Rumsfeld called them, complained that American forces were too light and lacked sufficient boots on the ground. Never have so many prognosticators and journalists been so wrong about so much. The elite Republican Guard, which supposedly would fight for every inch of Baghdad, collapsed without a fight. On April 9th, in just over 2 weeks of fighting, mostly against irregular troops, American armor swept through the desert and into the center of Baghdad. Once the local residents realized Saddam was indeed gone, large celebrations began, with Iraqis throwing flowers and cheering American soldiers with "Bush, Bush, Bush," and "We love America." In what was sure to be one of the most memorable scenes of the new century, Iraqi civilians, aided by American trucks, tore down a massive statue of Saddam in the center of Baghdad, then proceeded to drag the head around town as people beat it with their shoes and spat on it. Iraq was a demonstration of the Western way of war at its pinnacle, or what one Middle Eastern commentator glumly labeled an example of Mesopotamian show and tell. The message was not lost on other regimes in the region or around the world. Libyan dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi soon announced he was giving up his arsenal of WMD. It went unstated that he did not want the United States to have a Libyan version of show and tell. On June 28th, an interim free Iraqi government took official control of the nation, and Hussein entered pleas before a judge within a week. Within a period of 2 years, Bush had effectively cleaned out 2 major terrorist harbors, neutralized a third, and prompted internal democratic change in Saudi Arabia. But matters in Iraq turned for the worse. As Allied forces fought the insurgents, looting took place. Al-Qaeda bombers, often suicide bombers, killed hundreds of civilians and forced the UN out of the country. Bombings in Madrid, Spain, caused that once strong ally to leave the coalition. And up to that point, no WMDs were found. Election 2004. Swift boats. George W. Bush's popularity rose and fell with public perceptions of the war on terror and the mission in Iraq. He had been at stratospheric levels after 9/11 and after the beginning of Operation Iraqi Freedom, then watched his numbers steadily decline as criticism of the war mounted from the left and as domestic issues, especially the economy, assumed center stage. The Senate Democrats, as revealed in an internal memo, had agreed not to present Bush with a single legislative victory and to stall until the 2004 election, further adding to the view that Bush was accomplishing little. Adding to dissatisfaction with his performance, in 2002, Bush signed the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, better known as McCain-Feingold, for its sponsors, Senators John McCain, Republican, Arizona, and Russell Feingold, Democrat, Wisconsin. The act attempted to regulate the amount of soft money that could go to the parties, unaccounted donations that did not go directly to a candidate, thus did not count under the rules against that candidate's cap, but to specific issues associated with a candidate. For example, the National Rifle Association or the American Civil Liberties Union could run issue ads that clearly supported a candidate without naming the person. McCain-Feingold had enough support to overturn a veto, so Bush signed the bill. It portended an abridgment of free speech, especially from those who did not have access to the mainstream media, which included major newspapers, television, and radio. And it seemed to shift power back to the established media elites, who, under the guise of news, could report favorably or unfavorably on the candidates and issues of their choice. Ironically, campaign finance reform resulted in more money than ever flowing into campaigns, although not directly to candidates or parties anymore, but to political action committees, PACs, that used issue ads to attack unnamed opponents. One of the most effective was the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, which emerged when Senator John Kerry, Democrat, Massachusetts, became the official nominee of the Democratic Party at its 2004 convention. Kerry had served in Vietnam for an unusually brief tour of duty, and although he won 3 Purple Hearts and a Bronze Star, the circumstances under which he had received those commendations was challenged by many veterans who served with him. A 527 organization, named for the Internal Revenue System tax code number it used, the Swift Boat Veterans, purchased television advertising time with its own money to challenge the heroic image Kerry portrayed at the convention. The Swift Boats were small river craft, similar to World War II-era PT boats that Kerry served on. In their ads, the Swift vets emphasized 2 main points. 1, Kerry had received commendations he did not deserve and had not earned. And 2, Kerry's participation in the 1971 Vietnam Veterans Against the War's Winter Soldier investigation, in which he said U.S. troops had raped, cut off ears, cut off heads, taped wires from portable telephones to human genitals and turned up the power, cut off limbs, blown up bodies, randomly shot at civilians, and razed villages in fashion reminiscent of Genghis Khan. The ads proved devastating, and subsequent polls revealed that Kerry was unable to gain any traction against Bush on Iraq, the war on terror, or national security issues. Analysts subsequently concluded that the 4 Swift Vet ads seriously damaged Kerry's campaign. The issue of advertising by independent political action committees under the protections of free speech came before the U.S. Supreme Court in 2009 in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case, where parts of McCain-Feingold were rolled back. It constituted a major victory for free speech, but an incomplete one. Bush, meanwhile, nominated in New York City, campaigned on his performance as commander-in-chief. Polls showed the 2 neck and neck, although Bush never trailed in tallies of electoral votes. In early September 2004, CBS News ran a major and completely fraudulent hit piece on Bush's Texas Air National Guard service on its primetime show 60 Minutes, in which journalist Dan Rather claimed to have new documents showing Bush had ducked out of most of his service in the Texas Air National Guard during the Vietnam War. In a remarkable display of the increasing power of the internet and the new media to empower users to assess information immediately, several sources quickly analyzed the documents provided by CBS and proved them to be fakes, typed with typewriters that did not exist at the time by secretaries who claimed they never even saw them. Within 3 weeks, the fraudulent nature of the documents was obvious to the executives at CBS News, which issued a public repudiation. When the votes were tallied, Bush had increased his electoral count over that of 2000 to 286, picking up New Mexico and Iowa and losing New Hampshire. The red states had gotten redder and the blue states had gotten fewer. More surprising, Bush had coattails that Ronald Reagan never had, increasing the GOP lead in the Senate to 55-44 with one independent who voted consistently Democratic, and increasing the Republicans' margin in the House to 231-200-1. Republican majorities were important in the Senate, where Bush would have new Supreme Court vacancies to fill. After a bitter struggle with the Senate Democrats over federal circuit and appeals court judges, the Republicans had mustered the will to confirm several conservatives to the lower courts. Then Bush named John Roberts and Samuel Alito, two supposed strict constructionists, to fill the Rehnquist and O'Connor seats, and both were confirmed. Still, Justice David Souter, appointed by Bush's father, proved the most unreliable vote. This was demonstrated in the Kelo versus City of New London decision in 2005, where both so-called conservatives, Anthony Kennedy and Souter, sided with liberals to rule that all it took was a government purpose to transfer land from one private owner to another private owner. Such legal reasoning had never before been used in American history. Iraq, reversals and triumph. In 2003, the U.S. Army started investigating accounts of prisoner abuse and/or torture at the Abu Ghraib prison facility in Baghdad, under the control of the 372nd Military Police Company. Several months later, both the New Yorker and New York Times ran several articles, the Times publishing an incredible 30 page one stories on the scandal, about Abu Ghraib. 17 soldiers and officers were removed from duty, investigated, and 7 charged with dereliction of duty. 2 were sentenced to prison, and the commanding general was demoted to colonel. Widespread photos of torture often reflected injuries that the prisoners had arrived with, and the abuse for which Lindy England and Charles Grainer were charged included threatening the prisoners with dogs, which did not attack, making prisoners simulate sex with each other, and putting prisoners on dog leashes. Although the United States had moved to address the abuse and publicly made apologetic statements, the message sent to terrorists, especially of Arab shame-honor cultures, was chilling. American women are dominating your finest fighters. But while the American media focused obsessively on Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, the real war had reached a tipping point in the fall of 2004. Earlier that year, terrorists murdered and mutilated 4 American civilian contractors in the city of Fallujah. Bush instructed the military to take immediate action, but after investigation of the enemy positions, the Marines urged attrition of the enemy strength before getting into a block-by-block struggle. At the same time, the Iraqi Interim Government Council quietly announced that several of its members would oppose a bloody conquest of the city. Shortly after Bush's re-election, the military entered Fallujah and crushed the remaining terrorists. Fallujah's fall marked an important step in the Iraq campaign, although the Al-Anbar province, where it was located, continued to be an Al-Qaeda hotbed. By 2007, 3 developments put the United States on the final path to victory in Iraq. First, at the recommendation of an Iraq study group, a bipartisan congressionally appointed panel, Bush accepted recommendations to beef up combat strength by over 18,000 troops, most of whom were genuine fighters and not logisticians or support personnel. Surge troops were detailed to Baghdad and the Al-Anbar province specifically to stop violence against civilians. Second, Al-Qaeda overplayed its hand badly in Al-Anbar, alienating the Iraqi tribal leaders, who soon threw in with the United States in what was called the Anbar Awakening. They evicted Al-Qaeda terrorists, helped identify them to American forces, and soon the nation began to stabilize. Last, U.S. military and intelligence agencies ramped up their operations against top insurgency and Al-Qaeda figures in Iraq, and as a result, some 85% of successful operations came as a result of new sources uncovered by the intelligence operations. The Jordanian whom al-Qaeda sent to Iraq to head terrorist efforts there, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, was killed in June 2006, further damaging al-Qaeda's leadership. Although Iraq remained a campaign issue, most of the Democrat candidates for president in 2008 would promise in one form or another to withdraw, including the eventual winner, Barack Obama. The war was already winding down. Yet the threat had not disappeared. As the other member of the Axis of Evil, Iran strove to acquire its own nuclear weapons. Both Iraq and Afghanistan would be necessary bookends to launch an invasion if the Iranians did not back down. Democrat criticism of Bush, combined with the failure to turn up or make public significant amounts of WMDs, seriously damaged the credibility of the administration. But in July 2007, too late to seriously reverse the public perception that Bush lied, CNN reported that the United States had transported out of Iraq more than 500 metric tons of yellow cake uranium to Canada that had remained since the Gulf War, but which Saddam had still refused to acknowledge. The 500 tons of uranium from a nation that had no nuclear reactors should have raised eyebrows among even the staunchest no WMDs in Iraq Bush haters, and in many ways made the president's case that Iraq had WMD capability irrefutable. Nevertheless, far more than the failure to find and publicize large numbers of WMDs, the administration's unwillingness to contest the issue destroyed Bush's popularity ratings. As his political advisor Karl Rove later wrote, "Our weak response in defense of the president and in setting the record straight was one of the biggest mistakes of the Bush years. When the pattern of Democratic attacks became apparent in July 2003, we should have countered in a forceful and overwhelming way. We should have seen it for what it was, a poison-tipped dagger aimed at the heart of the Bush presidency." A mighty wind. Bush's reputation was about to receive another body blow. During an active hurricane season, Hurricane Katrina reached the Gulf Coast on August 29, 2005. Rated a Category 5 hurricane, it was the sixth strongest hurricane ever recorded in the Atlantic, and by the time it reached land in the United States, possibly the biggest ever. Smashing through Mobile, Biloxi, and Gulfport, Katrina devastated housing and businesses several miles inland. An alligator was reported to have been deposited into a suburban swimming pool 10 miles from shore, and the high water mark at the casinos on the water's edge near Biloxi reached 38 feet. The worst damage, however, came in New Orleans. An evacuation had been ordered, but thousands were without transportation or refused to leave, and the city's mayor, Ray Nagin, fiddled while Katrina swelled. Although 80% of the population managed to evacuate, Nagin allowed hundreds of city public school buses to sit empty, even as people begged for transportation out of the city. Some 26,000 of New Orleans' poorest people went to the Louisiana Superdome, the home of major sports activities. As thousands crowded in, the Superdome became the scene of predatory gangs, inadequate water and food, and abysmal sanitation. Reports of feces smeared on the walls and thugs raping helpless women soon reached the public. Adding to the immediate woes of Katrina, in New Orleans, the storm surge caused the levees separating Lake Pontchartrain from the city itself to break, flooding 80% of the city and many of the neighboring parishes. Rescue boats were fired on by gang-related snipers. While the hurricane passed, looting, vandalism, and violence ensued, with New Orleans police either unable or unwilling to curtail it. Despite later criticisms of a racial interpretation of the news, there was a distinction, as one described it, a community of beggars crowding the sports arena as the Hebrew cripples at the Pool of Bethesda, between people genuinely taking food from stores and those carrying off shopping carts or boats full of televisions, CD players, and the like. One congressman, William Jefferson, Democrat, Louisiana, used federal emergency responders to help save valuables in his home and office. Looters not only stole with abandon, but broke into world-famous restaurants and defecated on tables and cooking surfaces. It stood in sharp contrast to the response by citizens in Johnstown and Dayton in 1889 and 1913, respectively, to similar horribly devastating floods, and reflected the prevalence of attitudes that government, not individuals themselves, was responsible for people's welfare in times of emergency. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, had already warned that direct hurricane strikes could cause flooding, but even then was abysmally unprepared for the aftermath. Trucks meant to deliver ice drove around Georgia for days. Volunteers were turned back. Squabbles between state, federal, and New Orleans officials were routine. Nagin, who was convicted of embezzlement in 2014, and Democratic Governor Kathleen Blanco sought to blame the Bush administration, which had been slow in response, for their own failures. In many cases, the state and local officials had been given all the authority they needed and still did not act. Nevertheless, FEMA Director Michael Brown had appeared unconcerned and passive, and federal help only seriously kicked in when Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff assumed control of the operation. Brown later resigned. Ultimately, the federal government provided housing assistance to 700,000 people. Thousands were relocated to Houston and other cities, and FEMA paid the hotel costs of more than 12,000 people. Overall, however, FEMA's response to the disaster was pitiful. Katrina's cost was staggering, $75 billion, or between 0.5% and 1% of U.S. GNP, and the shutdown of an important port and its corollary gasoline refineries. Some 90,000 square miles were affected, and more than 1,800 killed, and another 1,800 missing. However, the lessons of Katrina were not so much that the federal government failed, but that there was massive failure at all levels of government. Where individuals and private organizations and companies took charge, evacuation was quick and decisive, and rebuilding much faster than where a bureaucracy was involved. With the ongoing bad news out of Iraq, Bush and the Republicans began to suffer. Bush did not help his cause by endorsing a number of big government policies or Democrat-sponsored positions in his second term, perhaps the worst of which was his attempt at immigration reform. This amounted to little more than amnesty for up to 12 million illegal immigrants, most of them from Mexico in the United States. The illegal immigration issue proved the coup de grace for the Republicans in the Bush era, crashing down in the 2006 elections, where they lost control of both the House by 31 seats and Senate by a 2-seat margin. Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco became the first female Speaker of the House, and Keith Ellison of Minnesota became the first Muslim member of Congress. Although the new class of Democrats, especially in the Senate, ran as moderates, they were often extremists to the far left of Clinton. And their arrival with big government solutions came just as the U.S. economy was about to melt down. Money, homes, and the new economy. After 9/11, the American economy slowly began to recover, adding 6 million net new jobs under Bush's two terms. But the free-spending Bush contributed to the nation's growing national debt, and foreign competition, especially China and India, seemed to be cutting into America's lead in almost every field. Harvard economist Richard Freeman predicted that U.S. technological competitiveness would soon be challenged by China. Yet foreign confidence in America remained strong, largely because other available options were sinking fast. Beginning in the 1990s, once mighty Japan had seen its economy slow, and by 2008, construction cranes around the world began to halt their work. Greece, Italy, Spain, Ireland, and Portugal all saw their social spending bring their budgets to crisis levels. Therefore, money still flowed to America. In 2007 alone, foreign investors poured $276 billion into the American economy, a 500% increase over 2002 levels. Yet this only masked deeper economic issues. Science degrees in the United States had fallen to 1980s levels, and the American-originated share of scientific papers and citations in scientific journals fell, on the Chemical Abstract Service, by half from 1983 to 2003. And the U.S. share of income related to other countries remained constant. As of 2000, most European countries and Japan still were only at about 75 to 80% of American income levels, while America's share of world manufacturing had hardly changed since the 1990s. One explanation was that American productivity continued to increase, especially in services, which had outpaced manufacturing productivity. In one study, productivity increased in all but 5 of the 29 sectors examined. Other studies, such as those of Amar Bidet, found that consumers were increasingly becoming productivity drivers with their suggestions and requests for new applications on electronic devices. International conferences on entrepreneurship confirmed that everyone still chased the USA. One observer at such a conference in England reported, "Speaker after speaker emphasized the importance of securing U.S. sales, but there was virtually no mention of the equally populous and more proximate market in continental Europe." Still, the realities of market economics could be forestalled for only so long, and weaknesses had already appeared in the economy as early as 2007 when the U.S. housing bubble burst. The housing boom was utterly unsustainable, especially in some of the truly hot markets. Housing prices in San Mateo, California, for example, soared at a rate of $2,000 a day. And by 2006, the median price for a 1,600-square-foot house in California was $561,000. Many other locations saw unbelievable levels of price escalation. Las Vegas and Phoenix in particular, but also entire regions within Florida and Virginia. Nationwide, home prices rose at a 13% a year clip. Two major factors explained this growth. First, a predictable cycle developed in which people began to count on further value in their homes as home prices rose. So, increasingly, in the 1990s and early 2000s, homeowners borrowed against the ever-rising equity in their houses. Homes became little more than large-scale ATMs. House flipping became a common practice, as individuals would acquire a bargain house, fix it up, and sell it, all within a period of months. As more houses were flipped, prices rose further. Second, as early as 1995, regulators under Clinton began strong-arming banks to make a specified number of loans to minorities, whether they could really afford them or not. Congressman Barney Frank, Democrat, Massachusetts, and Senator Chris Dodd, Democrat, Connecticut, put pressure on the Federal National Mortgage Association, Fannie Mae, and the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, Freddie Mac, and were particularly culpable in forcing banks to loosen their standards. Fannie and Freddie, as they were known, were government-created but privately owned lenders who bought mortgages from commercial and mortgage banks. As their standards loosened, local bankers had no choice and no excuse other than to make the loans the government wanted. In 2004 alone, the two mortgage giants gobbled up $1 trillion worth of subprime mortgages, holding at one point up to two-thirds of all mortgages in the United States. Emphasis in original. Yet the recipients of these mortgages had obtained them on the flimsiest of financial foundations. Many put down less than 10%, when the norm in previous years had been 30%, and many more obtained infamous zero-down mortgages. Lenders also offered interest-only mortgages, meaning that the buyer didn't obtain a cent of equity in his house with his monthly payment. Even then, many of the truly unqualified borrowers who had now been empowered to own a home could not make their payments. In 2007, the party ended. Foreclosure rates across the nation leaped 87% from the previous year, but the plummet was particularly acute in the hot spots. California saw the average home price crash by $100,000 in a single year. Suddenly, average people who had counted on rising home values to fund college loans or new car purchases were underwater, owing more than their houses were worth. This was particularly true, again, for anyone foolish enough to take a no-money down or an interest-only loan. But that was just the tip of the iceberg. Falling home values and foreclosures instantly transformed the balance sheets of any large institution holding mortgage debt. Needless to say, Fannie and Freddie needed a bailout. But so did large investment banks such as J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, AIG, Bank of America, Lehman Brothers, and many others. The new chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, a Bush appointee who, as a college professor, had specialized in the study of the Great Depression, feared a new Great Depression. He and Bush's Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, pressured the president to intervene. Despite seeing it as a breathtaking intervention in the free market, Bush agreed. He pushed Congress, which was all too eager to spend taxpayer money, to approve the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, thereby dumping $700 billion into the banking sector. CEOs of the eight biggest investment banks were hauled into a meeting with Paulson and Bernanke and flatly informed that they would take the loans, whether their particular bank needed the money or not. Citibank's Jamie Dimon was incensed, given that his bank was, for the moment, solvent. But Bernanke and Paulson warned that a run on the bad banks would affect the good banks, and in the end, Dimon, like everyone else, acquiesced. It would be erroneous to pin the entire blame on government. In many ways, this was, after all, a good old-fashioned tulip mania, an artificial boom that could have corrected itself. But the government regulations tilted loans sharply to those who were unqualified to borrow and guaranteed a disaster would follow. The blank slate candidate. As the Bush presidency drifted to an end, Republicans expected the Democrats to run Hillary Clinton in 2008. Instead, a new face appeared on the political landscape, Barack Hussein Obama. No candidate had done a better job of concealing his radicalism than Obama, who quickly posed a significant challenge to Clinton in the primaries. The Clinton machine, known for its cutthroat political tactics, seemed at a loss in dealing with the new threat. Obama had remarkable vulnerabilities as a candidate, both in the primaries and in the general election. His place of birth continued to be challenged in lawsuits as late as 2011, at which time Obama was forced to release his long-form Hawaiian birth certificate, although his Occidental College and Columbia University records remained sealed, adding to questions about his academic record. Obama's Kenyan father and his primary mentor, Frank Marshall Davis, were communists. Having lived in Indonesia and Hawaii, Obama moved to Los Angeles and attended Occidental College, then Columbia University in New York. Virtually none of his classmates remember him. He later attended Harvard Law School and became the first black president of the Harvard Law Review, yet never actually wrote anything for the publication. His 1995 book, Dreams from My Father, revealed a deep-seated hatred of British imperialism and was laced with racial grievances. After working briefly as a lawyer and then as a community organizer in Chicago, he ran for the Illinois State Senate in 1996 and won. There, his most common vote was present, and he in no way distinguished himself. However, in 2006, he ran for the U.S. Senate seat in Illinois and successfully used scandal to oust the Republican opponent Jack Ryan. Throughout his political career, Obama only once faced a serious candidate, Congressman Bobby Rush. He lost. In 2004, his Democratic National Convention keynote speech thrust him on the national stage, but the 2008 nomination was still considered Hillary Clinton's. However, Hillary had cast a vote in favor of the Iraq War resolution in 2003, alienating the left wing of the party. Obama was younger and hipper than Hillary, and as the first black candidate with a genuine chance of winning the presidency, he was lionized by liberals and fawned over by the press. After securing the nomination, Obama faced an uninspired Republican Senator John McCain, who from the outset instructed his staff not to attack Obama, fearful of racism charges. That effectively meant that Obama's record would not be exposed, for the media had made it clear that it would not examine him critically. It was a recipe for a loss. McCain's only boost came from selecting the charismatic, attractive, and conservative Sarah Palin, governor of Alaska, as his running mate. But with complete opposition from the press, the election was barely in doubt. McCain led until the TARP crisis, when he suspended his campaign and returned to Washington, only to have Obama take credit for the TARP bill. Obama had one other significant advantage over McCain. He was the first new media candidate, claiming 2.3 million Facebook friends to McCain's 622,000. Having four times as many visitors to his website as McCain, and posting six times as many videos on YouTube. In the number of videos mentioned online about either candidate, Obama had a lead of 300 million and led in Twitter followers by galactic levels over McCain. The only mystery is how, with such massive advantages, Obama did not score a Reagan-sized blowout in the election. The hoopla built up around Obama, such as had previously only been seen with messianic figures such as Woodrow Wilson or Mahatma Gandhi. Reminiscent of JFK, he drew a massive crowd in Berlin for his World That Stands as One speech, which outlined a sinister view of America as a worldwide oppressor and polluter. Subscribing to the unproven notion of global warming, Obama claimed, "Cars in Boston and factories in Beijing are melting the ice caps." He spoke these words just as the United States and the world were about to go into the coldest decade in recent history. Repeatedly, Obama apologized to other parts of the world for America's sins, noting that "there are times when our actions around the world have not lived up to our best intentions." At first, the Europeans and then the rest of the world were enamored with the younger candidate. But it didn't take long for outsiders to change their tune. Just 2 years after his German speech, Der Spiegel would call Obama cold, arrogant, and elitist. In Pakistan, despite another apology speech in Cairo in 2009, negative perceptions of the U.S. rose during Obama's term. British newspapers condemned his rudeness and appalling behavior during a 2009 visit. French President Nicolas Sarkozy described Obama as naive, inexperienced, foolish, and unrealistic. The New Delhi Sunday Pioneer called Obama arrogant and abrasive. By 2013, the president's approval numbers had fallen below the 40% range, lower even than George W. Bush's at the same point in his presidency. Obama dwelt upon himself more than any president in history and spoke more than any other president. In his first 8 months in office alone, he gave 41 major addresses, during which he referred to himself in the first person almost 1,200 times. At an Ohio speech on jobs in January 2010, after referring to himself 132 times, he insisted, "It's not about me." He received the most favorable, even fawning treatment from the media ever experienced by a president, being placed on half of Time magazine's covers in the months after November 2008 and gracing Newsweek's covers 12 out of 52 times. Elementary school children were taught to sing songs about him, and in 2009 he was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize for no discernible accomplishments. Obama had no opposition capable of stopping anything he wanted to do. Democrats had veto-proof majorities in both the House and Senate. They immediately pushed through a massive Keynesian-style spending bill to stimulate the economy that was little more than a gigantic sop to unions and green energy companies. Most of all, this law and all the Democrats' other planned policies promised huge tax increases in the future. In February 2009, an influential business reporter analyst named Rick Santelli burst into a tirade about high taxation levels and suggested it was time for a new Tea Party. All the news media outlets picked up on Santelli's comments, and within 2 months, a nationwide opposition to Obama was energized under the rubric of Tea Party groups, standing for Taxed Enough Already. Though the mainstream media and the Democrats ridiculed and unceasingly criticized the Tea Party, it was difficult to attack, as it had no single national leader or personality who could be demonized. But the Tea Party's warnings were on target. In early 2009, after the stimulus, the economy had 2.6 million fewer jobs than even under the sluggish Bush years. Yet federal spending rose by over $12,000 per household more than before Obama took office. The wealthy went on a capital strike, and despite interest rates of near zero, banks made few loans. Unemployment reached 10%, but the unofficial rate that included those no longer looking for work soared to over 20%. In fact, to keep the official unemployment rate lower, the government deleted 5.6 million workers from its official compilation as part of the body of workers looking for jobs. But the worst was yet to come. The Obamacare debacle. Obama's signature campaign issue had been a nationalized healthcare system based on European models and Hillary Clinton's Hillary Care fiasco in 1993. With the Democrats' total control of both houses of Congress and the presidency, the health care bill represented a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to vastly expand government. Although many congressmen understood they would lose their seats if they voted for Obamacare, as the Affordable Care Act was called, they committed political suicide to ensure its passage. Even though the bill steadily gained opposition, it passed without a single Republican in the House voting for it. The strategy was simple. Roll out the program in bite-size increments with Obama's allies in the unions and in business taking the hit in order to sell it to the American public. That strategy fell apart immediately. Hundreds of companies, mostly Democrat favorites, won exemptions, and the unions were exempted. more and more waivers were granted until only uninsured individuals remained. Obama intended that the young and healthy would sign up for the government-endorsed insurance exchanges, but they overwhelmingly rejected the burden. That left only the older, sicker Americans to sign up, meaning from the outset the program was doomed to insolvency. Many states refused to participate, and the nation looked to the October 2013 website rollout as a barometer of the public's reaction to Obamacare. By early 2014, Obama was still issuing orders to delay or exempt different groups, and while evidence was hard to come by for even the most dogged news sources, three developments were apparent. First, many of those who had signed up either had not paid or could not quickly verify their insurance to a medical facility. Second, a large percentage of the Obamacare signups came from the expansion of Medicare under Obamacare. Finally, the lack of security on the government websites opened any enrollee up to significant risk of the exposure of personal data. Healthcare was only one example of the new reality that no aspect of American life seemed outside the grasp of the government. Already, the government, under George W. Bush, had intruded in the auto industry by agreeing to a $50 billion loan bailout of General Motors, and as Obama began to direct the saving of the auto companies, Chrysler was also bankrupt, the two companies closed 2,500 dealerships and eliminated 100,000 jobs. Obama bullied the CEO of GM, promised the mayor of Detroit that GM would remain there, and dictated policies to Chrysler, all while saying he had no interest in and no intention of running GM. All of this galvanized the Tea Party further, and in 2010, Republicans, mostly infused with new Tea Party candidates, reclaimed the House and captured seats in the Senate, though they came up short in gaining the majority. Across the nation, at every level of government, state houses, governorships, mayoral races, Republicans crushed the Democrats, often gaining seats of historical significance. Several cities, for example, that had Democrat mayors for decades saw Republicans in the mayor's seat. But the Democrat-controlled Senate dug in its heels and refused to pass a constitutionally required budget for 4 years. With an administration that was clearly anti-business in place, American entrepreneurs hunkered down, creating few jobs. One of the most dramatic changes in employment involved the mancession, or the dramatic plunge in adult males. In the mid-1990s, 70% of American men were employed, but that number began to steadily fall under Obama to under 65% by 2010. That year, a record high of 2.94 million Americans claimed disability, and the number of households receiving food stamps similarly rose to a record 23 million, almost a 40% increase over 2008 when Obama was elected. Ironically, blacks and younger people were the hardest hit by Obama's policies, placing the burden of his presidency on his biggest supporters. For the first time, polls showed that people did not think their children would be better off than they were. In 2010, Social Security began to run deficits, and polls showed more young people believed in UFOs than thought they would ever see a Social Security check. Not surprisingly, polls also revealed overwhelming negativity toward the U.S. government, with 81% dissatisfied. Amidst this political and economic strife, America's culture had changed yet again, drifting toward a cult of celebrity. Television shows such as American Idol and Keeping Up with the Kardashians were propelled into top ratings. Interviews with the man on the street showed that people could more readily name the star of a reality show than a member of the U.S. Supreme Court. Celebrity's dark passenger. America's obsession with celebrities, building since the 1980s, began to show a more perverse side as early as 1999, when two malcontent teens, seeking, as they said in their journal entries, to outdo the Oklahoma City bombing, shot to death 12 fellow students and a teacher. Some would seek to blame bullying of the shooters, but in fact, they murdered people randomly, a scene that was repeated in 2007 at Virginia Tech University, where the mentally ill Soon-Hui Cho killed 32 people and wounded 17. At least one forensic pathologist concluded that Cho had a hatred toward the rich and saw himself as the savior of the oppressed, the downtrodden, the poor, and the rejected. In both cases, the quest for celebrity merged with mental illness and, it should be noted, the absence of anyone with a gun to oppose the lunatics. It is hypothesized that the perpetrator of another shooting in 2012 chose an Aurora, Colorado theater, which he selected specifically because he knew it was a gun-free zone. The deinstitutionalization of mentally ill people in the 1975 O'Connor versus Donaldson case made it nearly impossible to keep truly dangerous, crazy people off the streets until they committed a crime. Of course, American liberals attempted, with little success, to blame a gun culture. In fact, the actual number of mass killings had declined nationwide since the widespread passage of concealed carry laws in various states. Homicide rates, which had risen after the first real gun control laws went into effect in the mid-1960s, had fallen sharply as well. From 2000 to 2012, the number of non-related mass killings had fallen by half. In December 2012, the president of the National Rifle Association, in a brilliant preemptive strike, called for stationing an armed policeman at every American school. Although liberals howled, there was not much they could say. Obama's own daughters attended a school with 11 armed guards, and virtually all celebrities, including those who pleaded for gun control, were protected by armed bodyguards. Despite an initial attempt to reinvigorate anti-gun sentiment, the Democrats were unsuccessful, and the gun issue scarcely played a role in the campaign. Instead, the economy once again took center stage. You didn't build that. As Obama pitched his economic recovery policies across the nation to people who still had seen no recovery, in July 2012, he committed a gaffe that, under other circumstances, would have sunk even an incumbent president. If you were successful, somebody along the line gave you some help. There was a great teacher somewhere in your life. Somebody helped to create this unbelievable American system that we have that allowed you to thrive. Somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you've got a business, you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen. In a mere 5 sentences, Obama had denigrated the American dream and bashed entrepreneurship. By crediting government with the success achieved by individuals, Obama made clear his view of the private sector, that real achievement came only from government action. As the 2012 presidential campaign approached, Obama should have expected fallout. But once again, the Republicans nominated a moderate with no inclination to attack Obama head-on. Mitt Romney, former governor of Massachusetts and the architect of a state-level version of Obamacare, said in a private meeting that 47% of Americans paid no income taxes, which was true and, in fact, was a low estimate. But his comments were spun by the class warfare Obama administration as supposed evidence of his support for tax cuts for the rich. The ironic reality was that the stock market, after a dip in 2007 to 2009, had made a dramatic and steady recovery, so that under Obama, the wealthiest 1% prospered while all other groups suffered. Because Romney was unwilling to link Obama to his policies, he had no chance of winning, and in the process alienated millions of conservatives who stayed home on Election Day. Obama got 4 million fewer votes than he did in 2008, but carried Florida, Ohio, Colorado, and Virginia, and he became the only Democrat since Roosevelt in 1944 to win re-election with 50% of the vote. A new term, the low-information voter, was introduced in the 2012 election, describing those who paid little attention to issues and voted on one or two sound bites of a candidate. Of course, political campaigns had appealed to low-information voters since slogans such as Rum, Romanism, and Rebellion were in vogue, and while Americans were certainly less informed than they could have been, there is little to suggest they knew less than the typical voter in Boss Tweed's New York. Likewise, the popular notion that politics had gotten meaner or dirtier was bogus, largely a creation of the liberal media to insulate Democrats from criticism. It should be remembered that the Vice President of the United States once killed the former Secretary of the Treasury over words that violated his perception of honor, and that President Andrew Jackson had fought numerous duels over things opponents said. In other words, in a previous era, one could be killed for criticizing political opponents. Virulent opposition to both FDR and Nixon far exceeded that directed against Bush or Obama, so politics certainly had not gotten any meaner or less sensitive. Obama proceeded to implement Obamacare over the strong opposition of the Republican House. Democrats had cleverly tied funding of Obamacare to the overall federal budget. When the House passed a budget without Obamacare, the Senate would simply reinsert the wording. Nothing was solved in conference committees, meaning the House either had to sign off on Obamacare funding or shut down the federal government, which it attempted to do in the fall of 2013. Although the media deemed the tactic a failure, it ensured that the public focused on Obamacare as it was formally unveiled. When the Obamacare website went public in October 2013, it was one of the most extraordinary failures in government history. No one, including the Secretary of Health and Human Services, could log into the website. Personal information, even when someone did not buy insurance, became public and was permanently held by the government. There was no way to actually collect the funds from most people, and so on. Obama announced one delay after another, finally stating in December 2013, the last month for individuals to sign up, that they had a one-year extension. It should be remembered that according to the Affordable Care Act, anyone without insurance had to pay a fine, which escalated with each successive year. Therefore, Obama told people they could violate the law, but the law itself was not changed. Sign-ups, especially of the young, were a tiny fraction of what was needed to make the system solvent. Yet Republicans, who had almost unanimously run against Obamacare, wavered when it came time to actually defund Obamacare, and indeed agreed to a new budget in 2013 that pushed a debate on the national debt and its accompanying debt ceiling off till 2014. Whether the conservative Tea Party movement retained the strength and influence it had in 2010 was a question that would be answered in the future. Home and abroad. Obama's America was in many ways like a caged giant, ready to explode, and the source of that explosion was a vast, untapped wealth of natural energy that had been discovered inside America's borders. The deposits of oil and shale in Middle North America grew with each new estimate, meaning that, as a Harvard Business School study said in 2012, oil is not in short supply. If permitted unrestricted production and exploration, American oil fields could reach 50 million barrels of regular oil a day, not counting those acquired through fracking, or the new process of hydraulic fracturing. None of this set well with Obama, who despised oil, gas, and coal as fuels, and whose energy secretary, Stephen Chu, said that in order to force Americans to use unpopular alternative energy, somehow we have to boost the price of gasoline to the levels in Europe, or $8 a gallon when Americans paid about $3.50 per gallon. Obama's transportation secretary, Ray LaHood, wanted to coerce people out of their cars. The Obama administration gave millions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies and loans to green energy companies, which went bankrupt one after another, with the most notorious being Solyndra, a solar power company. Those subsidies, all under the auspices of creating jobs, worked out in Solyndra's case to $1.3 million per job created. And Obama's own officials warned him in 2010 that it would soon collapse. Yet Solyndra nevertheless still got more loan guarantees. Naturally, the media refused to report on Solyndra's corruption until after the midterm election. Abroad, the Obama administration succeeded in withdrawing all U.S. troops from Iraq in 2011, yet the nation was hardly stabilized, and in early 2014, al-Qaeda-backed forces retook Fallujah in a stunning setback for the Iraq mission. In Afghanistan, the United States had more casualties in the first 3 years of the Obama administration than in Bush's entire 2 terms, and the effort there also appeared to be unraveling. Poll after poll showed that America's standing in the world had declined steadily from the end of the Bush terms. Thus, as America forged into the second decade of the 21st century, it did so with little confidence, optimism, or, to use one of Obama's key 2008 campaign slogans, hope. Personal privacy had reached an all-time low with the employment of drone aircraft and the 2012 leaks of classified National Security Agency, NSA, materials by Edward Snowden to the UK's Guardian. NSA snooping programs, he revealed, were harvesting millions of pieces of email and instant messages, as well as entire contact lists, tapping into internet giants Google and Yahoo to collect information on users and spying on virtually all domestic calls. Snowden's leaks further showed that the NSA was eavesdropping on its closest allies, a revelation that outraged the Germans in particular. When called before Congress to give account, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, lied to the representatives, denying outright that the NSA was spying domestically. In addition to unprecedented levels of government snooping, challenged by many as unconstitutional, the federal government, some states, and even many city governments around the nation found themselves increasingly unable to perform the most basic tasks. The U.S. Senate, after all, had not passed a budget in 5 years. California saw its businesses flee and needed constant remedial action to stave off bankruptcy. Some cities fared no better. In 2013, the city of Detroit, Michigan, declared bankruptcy, and New Yorkers elected a mayor with publicly known communist sympathies. Those developments meant that major parts of the United States were in perpetual disrepair. In response, many Americans left the failing regions seeking lower taxes and economic opportunity. Businesses fled California, New Jersey, and New York City for lower tax regions. All these trends, substantial malaise and dissatisfaction at home, distrust of government, high levels of unemployment combined with a small swath, often aided by government carve-outs, doing extremely well, sharply escalating national debt levels, swirled in the political waters in 2014. Yet at the same time, the United States more than ever still possessed the native talents of its population, including an inventiveness still unmatched in the world, with massive natural resources. The answer to which direction America would go was clouded, for, as Yoda said in The Empire Strikes Back, always in motion is the future. Conclusion. Several years ago, a video gaming magazine published a picture that featured Japanese soldiers recreating the Iwo Jima flag raising, but raising the Japanese Rising Sun flag, not the Stars and Stripes. The caption warned, "History is in your hands. Don't screw it up." This image serves as a reminder that, as Americans, success is not handed to us. It has been earned every step of the way, from George Washington's frozen volunteers marching 9 miles to the Trenton battlefield at night in a snowstorm, to the undaunted builders of the Panama Canal, from the courageous crew of the Challenger paving the way with their lives for continued space exploration, to Steve Jobs's geeks tirelessly hammering out newer and previously unimagined technological marvels. And from the boomer Sooners racing across open prairie to the American dream of land ownership, to the Navy SEALs who died alongside Marcus Luttrell in Afghanistan seeking to capture a top Taliban leader. It has always been individuals, never government, who made America great, and only individuals can restore American greatness in the future. If Americans know who they are and where they really come from, they will exert themselves even more to surpass previous generations. That is why the study of our history remains of critical importance. Our history is not just the story of who we once were, but of our destiny. Not of what we have accomplished, but of our future success. Greatness is not handed to us because we are Americans, rather, Americans, because of who they were and who they still are, have reached out and seized it. And so it still can be. If we behave like Americans and call on those values and inspirations that infused our fathers and their fathers before them, then no one on earth can deny greatness to the United States of America. This concludes the reading of A Patriot's History of the United States, Updated Edition, From Columbus's Great Discovery to America's Age of Entitlement, by Larry Schweikert and Michael Allen. Copyright 2004-2014 by Larry Schweikert and Michael Allen. This book was read by Patrick Lawler. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with New England Publishing Associates and was produced in 2016 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.